Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's the end of the week. You're getting ready for the weekend. And what better way to help you do that than with Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast? I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And if you've been listening to previous episodes of the podcast, you'll know that I was called to jury service downtown and was placed on the jury pool for a first-degree murder trial. Now, I was dismissed from jury service, but I'm still fascinated by it, by the process of selecting a jury and going to trial. So that's what I want to talk about today on Free for All Friday. Before I get to that, though, I do want to remind our listeners we have bonus content at TrenthornPodcast.com. The next installments are my catechism study series, my church history study series are up there. You'll definitely want to go and check those out. And if you're a subscriber to TrenthornPodcast.com, you'll get access to the upcoming Trent tracks on how to prove the divinity of Christ. That'll come out here in a week or two. And of course, your subscription is what makes the podcast possible. So here's what I want to talk about today on the podcast. I want to talk about voir dire. So voir dire is not some kind of appetizer you would eat alongside foie gras in a restaurant. It is the term that refers to the process of jury selection. It's something we don't think about, but many legal scholars and lawyers will tell you that one of the most important parts, if not the most important part of a jury trial, which can take place in a civil suit or in a criminal trial, is the selection of the jury. That if you get a jury that is not fair towards what you are arguing, whether you are the prosecution or the defense, you have very little chance of succeeding in either proving your case or disproving the case that's been put forward by the state. So you want to have a jury selected well right from the beginning, and that's the process of voir dire, not how it's mispronounced in My Cousin Vinny, which is actually a pretty, I've read some reviews of My Cousin Vinny, and by the way, I am not a legal scholar. I am not a lawyer. I've had some people tell me, hey, Trent, you should become a lawyer. I did sign up for the LSAT, Law School Aptitude Test. I think that's what it stands for. I signed up for the LSAT, the test you take to get into law school or to be rated for law school. But I ended up canceling. I never took the test because I realized that I was choosing to become a lawyer. I was going down that path for all the wrong reasons, mostly because people were telling me, hey, you'd make a good lawyer, not because I had an inner desire for it. But now the skills that people saw in me that would make a good lawyer actually have worked out well to be an apologist, because an apologist is one who gives a defense. And a lawyer basically does that. They either defend a client or they defend the evidence put forward by the state, at least in a criminal trial. So I like to tell people, I didn't become a lawyer, but I kind of am a lawyer for God. And in that case, it's nice knowing that your client is always innocent. So I was in researching this, and as I talk more about this, do know I'm not an expert in the law. I'm doing the best I can. I might have people who are listening to the podcast who are judges or lawyers. If I make a mistake, leave a comment at TrenthornPodcast.com. Doing the best I can. But in my research, I did see that the movie My Cousin Vinny, the 1992 comedy starring Marissa Tomei and Joe Pesci, is actually a pretty decent representation of several aspects of criminal court cases, including voir dire and cross-examination of witnesses. So here is Joe Pesci. He mentions it with a wonderful mispronunciation in this scene from My Cousin Vinny.
What you do in your father's garage?
Tune-ups, oil changes, brake relining, engine rebuilds, rebuild some trannies, rear end.
Okay.
So that is the other attorney, the prosecutor, and the woman on the stand is Marissa Tomei. She is Vinny's fiance. And if you haven't seen the movie, it's a great movie. I definitely recommend watching it. Rated R, some moral sensibilities may be offended, but it's a classic. So the idea here is that these two guys from New York go down to Alabama. They're falsely accused of a murder they didn't commit. And so they're recommended to say, hey, you should call your cousin Vinny. He's a lawyer, but he's a personal injury lawyer from Brooklyn. He's never actually done a major trial case before and does all these missteps, but he has a natural aptitude for cross-examination. And that shows through in the trial. So he brings actually his fiance, Mona Lisa, onto the stand to testify as an expert witness about tire tracks. Because at this point in the movie, I'm not going to spoil anything, tire tracks play a key role in determining if the defendants are guilty or innocent. So Pesci puts his fiance Mona Lisa on the stand, played by Marissa Tomei, and then the prosecutor's talking with her. He's trying to establish her as an expert witness about tire tracks, even though she's a mechanic. She works in her father's garage. So the scene continues.
Okay. But does being an ex-mechanic necessarily qualify you as being an expert on tire marks?
No. Thank you. Goodbye.
Sit down and stay there until you're told to leave.
Your Honor, Ms. Vito's expertise is in general automotive knowledge. It is in this area that her testimony will be applicable. Now, if Mr. Trotter wishes to voir dire a witness as to the extent of her expertise in this area, I'm sure he's going to be more than satisfied.
I love that. If he wants to voir dire my witness, voir dire, voir dire. The only other famous mispronunciation comes to my mind in film is when Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs says, "I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti." It's Chianti, Hannibal Lecter, Chianti. So voir dire is just the practice of jury selection. So when we think of jury selection, we can't think of it as the attorneys, both the prosecution and the defense, pick the people that they want to be on a jury. What happens is there's a pool of jurors, and both the prosecution and the defense has to agree on a juror being on the trial, because the Sixth Amendment gives us a right to a trial by jury, and it gives us the right to a trial that is impartial, that is fair, and consists of a jury of our peers, people who can fairly look at the evidence to ascertain guilt, that someone is guilty or that they are not guilty, that the state has failed to meet its burden to prove in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime. And so it's important to get voir dire and jury selection right. So Jeffrey Fredick, who is the director of jury research services at the National Legal Research Group, he's also the author of the book Mastering Voir Dire and Jury Selection. He says that when it comes to jury selection, quote, "It's not who I want, it's who I don't want." What we try to do is think of what backgrounds, life experiences, cognitive styles, opinions, and values jurors might have that would make them less receptive to our case. So the idea here is you have a pool of jurors, and I'm sure the prosecution and defense may know some people they really want on the jury, but that's not how it works. You get people who are proposed to be in the jury, and the prosecution or the defense, without any reason that is given, they don't have to give a reason, can just dismiss that person, say, we thank this person for their service, but they're not required to serve in this trial. Either the prosecution or the defense can do that. But if neither objects to a witness and the judge does not object to the witness, the judge can also excuse people. In the trial that I was on, the judge excused, I think, 3 people before we even got to voir dire, 30 of them for economic hardship, others just in the general part of getting to know the jurors. The judge just dismissed a few people right out of hand, but the majority of those who were dismissed after those who had pled economic hardship, that I can't be on a jury if I'm gone from work for 6 weeks, I won't be able to pay my rent or support my children. It was the prosecution and the defense who were doing the majority of dismissing jurors. And so this is a big deal. Like, attorneys will spend a lot of money. They'll hire consultants to come in and analyze the case and kind of do a psychological profile to see what kind of jurors are most likely to convict someone and also what jurors are going to be most sympathetic to the defendant. Here is a clip from Inside Edition. So not the classiest of news sources, but definitely one of the more entertaining ones that deals with the woman who was involved, Jo Ellen Dimitri. She was brought in as a voir dire consultant for the O.J. Simpson trial, and it was her consultation with both the defense, she consulted with the defense, but a similar write-up was given to the prosecution that I believe that ultimately led to O.J. Simpson being found not guilty because the jury was very sympathetic towards him and she was able to determine who would be sympathetic. So I'm going to play that clip so you can get a little bit more of an insight on voir dire and what goes in the minds of lawyers as they try to figure out who to pick for their cases.
She was the Dream Team's secret weapon, Jo Ellen Demetrius, the jury consultant who told O.J. Simpson's attorneys exactly who should be on the jury.
Does this bring back memories for you?
It does.
Demetrius says the producers of The People vs. O.J. Simpson got it right in their portrayal of her.
Among black women, O.J. received all 9s and 10s.
That's the jury consultant giving the Dream Team of lawyers the results of her research.
I'm surprised that black ladies liked O.J. so much. What exactly did they say?
Oh, it's very positive. They call O.J. handsome, masculine, and charming.
What, in your view, was the perfect juror?
The perfect juror was a female African-American with a high school education or less.
The dream team followed her advice all the way. Demetrius says lead prosecutor Marcia Clark also used a jury consultant and got the same analysis. But unlike the defense, Clark apparently chose to ignore it.
I think it would be wise to limit the number of African-American women on your jury.
She was very skeptical of that information. She'd been a very successful prosecutor, and she just felt like, why do I need this group of people coming in to tell me what I already know?
And that ultimately was one of the contributing factors, along with the testimony of Mark Furman in the OJ case, that led to OJ Simpson being acquitted of the charges. By the way, I've seen The People versus OJ Simpson. It's a pretty good series. It was on FX not too long ago. I don't know where you can watch it now, but I highly recommend watching it. I think everyone involved gave a really good performance. Cuba Gooding Jr. does a good OJ. I was quoting a lot of lines after it when I watched it with my wife. You'll be quoting things like, "The juice is loose." Remember that OJ Simpson? They called him the juice. I don't know if he got that nickname before or after he earned the Heisman football trophy or not. But when Mark Furman went on the stand and it showed that he had lied about using the N-word, for example, this jury that was predominant, there were only two white members of the jury. I think there were eight black members of the jury, two Hispanic members of the jury, and two white members of the jury. They were moved to then be very skeptical of the police, the evidence from the police, and much more likely to believe the defense's theories that the evidence had been planted against O.J. Simpson. So that goes back to showing that choosing a jury, choosing the jurors, is extremely important in a criminal case. And so when I went in, I was familiar with voir dire before I went in for the case. I didn't know that that's what it was called, but I was familiar with juror interrogation. And so I figured I would be asked questions. Now, I thought they were going to take me up on the stand, and I'd go up there by myself, and I would raise my hand by myself and say, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help you God?" I do, and I would sit down, and there'd be like this dramatic fashion where the prosecution and defense would each take their sweet time with Trenhorn asking me questions about myself. And then, you know, the defense would go too far, and I would say, "Objection. That's grounds for speculation." And I would turn to the judge and I'd say, "Your Honor, I move for a mistrial." And then the bailiff would walk me out because I had delusions of grandeur. And that is not what happened at all, actually. So what we did, a lot of times in cases, especially when you have a large jury pool, there's a wider voir dire that the defense and the prosecution will each get like an hour to ask the jurors as a whole questions and then allow the jurors to raise their hands and offer their answers. And so they did that with us and got through a lot of the jurors. They peppered through and got almost all of us to speak. And in that process, what they were trying to do, once again, remember, it's not about finding the people you want. It's more about finding the people you don't want. And so when you find somebody, you ask them questions and you want to see, does this person have a bias? People can claim they're going to be fair and impartial, but the problem is none of us are really unbiased. None of us are that 100% impartial. We have all kinds of experiences that shape us and will determine how we view evidence, how we make cases, how we ascertain whether people are trustworthy or reliable. And so the defense and prosecution were trying to do this, and they asked us kind of group questions, and I chimed in every now and then. And they also asked me some specific questions, specifically about my job, being a podcaster, being someone who has thought about things related to this case, that I've done podcast episodes on firearms. This case involves firearms. I'm somebody who might be talking a lot to the public about related issues. So they wanted to know that about me right away, but they didn't dwell on it. They moved on and tried to get through as many people as they could. And once again, the goal is to root out bias. So I want to share with you another clip. One way is just to root out bias. So I'm going to show you one more fictional clip of voir dire in action, and then I'll show you a real one so you get more of a sense of kind of what it's like. So this is a wonderful scene from the 1960 film Inherit the Wind. It's based on the Scopes monkey trial, where John Scopes, the Tennessee teacher, was found guilty of violating Tennessee's prohibition on teaching the theory of evolution. So he was put on trial, and it was William Jennings Bryan was the prosecution. He was someone who had run for president several times. He was a famous conservative populist candidate, and he represented the prosecution in the case. The defense for Scopes was Clarence Darrow, a non-religious, very famous lawyer. So it was a real clash of the titans, and it's some. Now it's not entirely accurate. There's a lot in Inherit the Wind that was made up. The Reverend Jeremiah, I believe, was a fictional character, but Inherit the Wind is still a wonderful drama if you take it as a drama. And so there's a scene at the beginning. You know, they go through the jury process to see if Scopes had broken. He has a different name in the movie. Had broken the law, and they want to get a jury that can be impartial. So here's a scene of voir dire where they have a typical juror on the stand, and Matthew Harrison Brady, who plays William Jennings Bryan, the prosecution, gets to interrogate, do voir dire with this prospective juror, and then I forget the name of the fictional name. He represents Clarence Darrow in it. So here's this fictional display of it.
Proceed with the selection of the final juror, Mort.
State your name and occupation, Jess.
Jesse H. Dunlop, farmer.
Mr. Davenport.
You believe in the Bible, Mr. Dunlop?
I believe in the holy word of God. And I believe in Matthew Harrison Brady.
Hallelujah, brother.
This man is acceptable to the prosecution.
Mr. Drummond?
No questions. Not acceptable.
Oh, so he's Henry Drummond in the movie, but he represents Clarence Darrow. I'll keep playing. They ask him, well, why? Why isn't he acceptable? Well, clearly the juror just said he is a big fan of the prosecutor. So if he's that biased in favor of the prosecutor, he can't be impartial for the jury trial and give the defense a fair hearing. That in and of itself would easily get you kicked off a jury. But then they go on, and I love the scene.
Does Mr. Drummond refuse this man a place on the jury simply because he believes in the Bible?
If you find an evolutionist in this town, you can refuse him.
I object to the defense attorney rejecting a worthy citizen without so much as asking him a question.
All right, I'll ask him a question. How are you?
Oh, kind of hot.
Me too. Excused.
And so the trial goes on once again. That's another movie that you need to watch, at least for the drama that's put into it, even if it's not necessarily historically accurate. All right, so what do the prosecution and the defense look for in prospective jurors? Particularly, what are they looking for as grounds for dismissal? In one sense, they're going to ask about your personal relationship. So if you don't really want to get on jury duty, first, don't lie. You don't want to lie to people. I did my best to be honest in everything that I shared. What Jesus would have said, what does it profit a man if he gains the week and doesn't have to go to jury duty, but he forfeits his soul in response? So you should be honest. But in many cases, when you share details about yourself, that could reveal possible examples of bias that won't work well in the jury box. So this includes obvious ones are relationships to those who are involved in the case. So if you are related to the defendant, related to the district attorney, the prosecutor, the judge, to key witnesses who are involved in the case, key experts will be testifying in the case. If you have relationships to those people, immediately you're probably not going to be allowed to serve on the jury. If you have enforcement with, if you have previous experience with law enforcement, either in being a law enforcer, judge, probation officer, corrections officer, police officer, federal agent, or on the other, if you have experience with law enforcement and having the law enforced against you, if you are an ex-con, if you've if your parents, relatives, friends, children have been found guilty in a court of law, if you or a loved one or a family member is a victim of a crime, especially of a crime similar to what the defendant is accused of, you might have a bias. So let's say you have a loved one who is a victim of a violent crime, and the person who is considered responsible was found not guilty, but you think they really did it. Now you're on a jury where someone is accused of a violent crime. You may feel like, I'm not going to let them get away again. And so you have a bias there, and the prosecution is going to be on the lookout for that. There's other things, though, that aren't as specific, looking for things like strong religious or moral beliefs that would preclude you from being fair and impartial or from even judging others. Like if you take thou shalt, you know, Jesus said, don't judge lest you be judged. If you take that too literally and you can't judge people or anything, you won't be fit for a jury. If you have a bad attitude, if someone sees that you're disagreeable or you're just kind of weird and you can't get along with people or follow questions that are asked of you, you may be seen as someone who's not really fit for the jury, someone who would be helpful, especially for the prosecution side, who needs a unanimous jury. Now, in a criminal case, you need the jury to be unanimous on either side. So in order for guilty, you need 12 votes. For not guilty, you also need 12 votes. So the defense also has to find unanimity among the jurors. They can't just throw bombs on the jury, because the problem is if it's a hung jury, if they can't come to a verdict, well, then the trial just starts all over again. You have a hung jury or, the verdict's thrown out, but you would just continue on to reissue the trial. So you'll want to look for things, leadership skills, interactions with others, even people seeing, do they dress well? I was in a dilemma. Like, I don't want to serve on the jury. I could dress like a slob, but I also like looking nice. So I decided to look nice and I didn't have to serve anyways. Your body language when you're in court. Another thing is excitement. If you are overly excited to be on the jury, it looks like you're being nice and agreeable, and it looks like you're hitting all the right notes to be on the jury. The prosecution or defense may choose to excuse you because it's suspicious that most people don't like jury service or jury duty. That if you are trying really hard to get on this jury, maybe you're doing so for nefarious reasons. Maybe you won't be impartial. Maybe you're secretly helping one side or the other, and so you don't want these kinds of people on. Other questions that are asked are just questions related to judicial philosophy, to make sure that the potential jurors understand philosophy of law, understand how our legal system works. This is a clip of Mark O'Mara doing voir dire on the George Zimmerman trial. This is back in, I think, 2013. George Zimmerman was accused of either murder or voluntary manslaughter. I forget the precise charge of Trayvon Martin, a young black man wearing a hoodie, and Zimmerman was part of the neighborhood watch. The two had a confrontation. I think it was alleged that Martin was like banging Zimmerman's head into the ground. They got into a scuffle and Zimmerman shot him. And so the question is, did Zimmerman commit manslaughter or was it a killing in self-defense? So Mark O'Mara was one of the defense attorneys for Zimmerman. And this is just giving an example of how voir dire works in a real case. And he just is asking people if they understand. He wants to see which jurors understand, or more importantly, which ones do not understand that you are presumed innocent until all of the evidence is in. So you can't say someone's guilty just because a killer piece of evidence, no pun intended, has come up in the trial. You got to wait until the end. You certainly can't presume that they're not innocent just by looking at them before the trial starts. So here is O'Mara engaging the jury with a real life voir dire.
Anyone have any concerns then with this presumption that Mr. Zimmerman, any citizen accused, carries into a courtroom? Ma'am, how do you think that presumption of innocence then is overcome by the state?
E6. They would have to produce first-hand witnesses and facts to overcome any reasonable doubt.
So if I'm going to paraphrase what you're saying and see what other people think about it, do you think that the presumption of innocence then stays until the state overcomes it beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes.
Okay. So what do you think about that?
P35. I believe that a person is completely innocent until proven guilty, because the person that's accusing them has to prove what they did wrong. If anything other than that, to me, is pretty much speculation or guessing if someone did something, because you don't really know until the proof comes out.
Okay, so you'll notice also that when the jurors speak up, they say E86 or P35. Those are the juror numbers. So most juries today, this changed with O.J. Simpson case, are given juror numbers to refer to themselves by in order to protect the juror's anonymity. In a small number of cases, that's to protect them from a dangerous defendant or a defendant who may have connections to dangerous elements in the community who might want to retaliate against the jury. But in most cases, just to give them general anonymity, help them be impartial, and also to keep the press away, because the press really hounded people who were the jurors on the O.J. Simpson trial. So you notice here, O'Mara is also doing wide voir dire. He's just, what do you think, sir? And you behind him, what do you think about that? Now, studies have shown that this wider voir dire yields less reliable results, and that when you don't have time to do extensive personal investigation with a potential juror, where you can ask them one-on-one questions over an extended period of time, there's a greater likelihood they will omit key details that you would have wanted to know. According to one website, results of a study in the District of Columbia Superior Court demonstrated that jurors disclose less in limited voir dire than in the expanded voir dire. When experimenters followed up with jurors in expanded voir dire, they learned a great deal of information. Some of the jurors' responses included, so some of these people in the wider voir dire, they just were asked a few questions. They later told experimenters who were doing a study on jury selection, quote, "I was frightened to raise my hand, but I do take blood pressure medication," which would be important in, let's say, it's a civil case, it's a suit against a pharmaceutical company. "I was on a hung jury before, and it dealt with a gun offense. I'm not sure I can be fair in this gun possession case. My grandson was killed with a gun." And here's my favorite one that was not disclosed in voir dire that should have been. "I'm the defendant's fiance. Is that okay?" No, that is not okay. You cannot be on the jury if you are the defendant's fiance. Another study, this is from thejuryexpert.com, said that a lot of potential jurors are prompted, they are subconsciously moved to give false or misleading answers to questions during voir dire because they're in a very structured format where they feel kind of intimidated. They may be hesitant to share personal information with strangers. It also says that when in an unfamiliar environment, people look to others as a guide for their behavior, causing many jurors to follow the crowd rather than express their own true feelings. I'll give you an example from me and my experience. When I was there, they asked a question, would you consider the testimony of someone, a convict, or let's say someone who is a prisoner, and they're brought into court wearing their, prisoner attire and their shackles are on. They have handcuffs and feet restraints, shackles. Would you have any problem with their testimony? You understand, like, they're just a person like you or anyone else. And everyone else in the pool was nodding along with the lawyer who was asking this question. And just saying, oh, yeah, of course, I would consider their testimony equal. And I raised my hand. And they called to me and I said, well, I'm not going to assume everything they say is false, but I'm sorry, I have a bias here that if a witness cannot be trusted to behave themselves in court, so much so that they, because many times the defendant may be in state custody, but they are allowed to sit at the table with their attorney without shackles, without handcuffs, because that would be prejudicial. If someone looks like a convict, you're more likely to convict them. So they may sit there, they may be in state custody, but allowed to be in a nice suit. They don't have handcuffs on. Usually they only have handcuffs and shackles on if there is a reasonable suspicion. You have probable cause to believe this person is a danger to others in court. They may try to escape. They could try to hurt somebody. So for me, I said, look, if this person, not everyone is shackled, but if it's a witness who's shackled, if we can't trust them to behave in court, why would I trust them to tell the truth? If you need shackles to control their limbs, what's going to control their tongue from saying something that's not true? Not that I believe, not that it's always false, but it does make me more skeptical. But I was the only one who voiced that opinion. And I'm betting you that among the 70 other people who were there, I'm sure there were other people who felt the same way, but they were not willing to speak up to go against the rest of the room. And so that's a challenge when you're trying to determine what people believe, that you want to root out people that have these kind of unpopular views or idiosyncratic views or views that that aren't as helpful in an impartial jury setting. And so, I got rooted out pretty quickly. But what about people who stay quiet? You roll the dice a bit. So we'll go on. Another reason that jurors remain quiet during these cases where they may not speak up is one, the common one. A lot of people have fear of public speaking. We're in a room with a judge, lawyers, 80 other people. There's a lot of people that are not comfortable speaking in front of large audiences. Now, me, I don't care. I'll get up there and I'll give the opening statement myself. I was joking my wife saying, I better dress up for court today. I mean, if the lawyer gets sick, I might have to fill in for somebody. I signed up for the LSAT once. I should be able to do this. but other people may not be comfortable sharing that. So I found that to be interesting. And it's important because you also, they ask us a lot of questions and make sure we understand. Do you understand the rules of being a juror? And so they gave us particular rules. Don't look up the case. Don't discuss it with anyone while you're serving. I've been dismissed, so it's fine for me to talk about it. You don't want to do that. And you don't want to go and investigate yourself. We had to sit downstairs. When I was downstairs, there were 200 other people before we got assigned to cases. And you go for the jury selection, and they show you a video, and it is super cheesy. It begins as a guy windsurfing, and it's like, California's the greatest state in the country, and that's because we have the greatest criminal justice system. What? I'm going to dispute a few of those points right there. But in the infomercial, you know, in the beginning orientation video they gave us, they said, if you're selected for a jury, do not attempt to investigate the case yourself. Do not go to the scene of the crime. Do not talk to witnesses. You are not allowed to gather. If you go and gather evidence yourself to bring into jury deliberations, that is grounds for a mistrial to have the case thrown out. That is why my favorite courtroom movie, I mean, my favorite number two for me is To Kill a Mockingbird. Number one, however, is 12 Angry Men. I love 12 Angry Men. It's a 1957 film, and it's based on a short story and screenplay by Reginald Rose. And it's basically about 12 guys who are on a jury who are deliberating whether an 18-year-old guy is guilty of murdering his father. And so they go in, and they initially vote. 11 say guilty. One, played by Henry Fonda, says not guilty. That's juror number eight. He says not guilty, and the rest of the movie is about juror number eight trying to convince the other 11 jurors to agree with him that there's not enough evidence. The evidence is not as clear as it seems. And for some of them, the evidence is clear because look, here's the knife. We've got the knife. We've got the murder weapon. It all seems very clear, but things are not as they seem, as this clip from 12 Angry Men will show.
What actually happened is this. The boy stayed home, had another fight with his father, stabbed him to death, and left the house at 10 minutes after 12. He even remembered to wipe the knife clean of fingerprints. Now, are you trying to tell me that this knife really fell through a hole in the boy's pocket, someone picked it up off the street, went to the boy's house, and stabbed his father with it just to test its sharpness?
No, I'm just saying it's possible the boy lost his knife and that somebody else stabbed his father with a similar knife. It's just possible.
Take a look at this knife. It's a very unusual knife. I've never seen one like it. Neither had the storekeeper who sold it to the boy. Aren't you asking us to accept a pretty incredible coincidence?
I'm just saying a coincidence is possible.
And I say it's not possible.
Then he stands up, takes a knife out of his pocket.
Where did that come from?
It's the same knife.
Thank you, June.
Where did you get it?
I went out walking for a couple of hours last night. I walked through the boy's neighborhood. I bought that in a little pawn shop just two blocks from the boy's house. It cost $6.
So he bought the exact same kind of knife that was in the trial. That was supposed to be this super unique knife that the odds of there being another knife like it are almost impossible. Henry Fonda, juror 8, he bought a knife the night before from the same neighborhood and brought it into the jury room.
It's against the law to buy or sell switchblade knives.
That's right. I broke the law.
Listen, you pulled a real bright trick. Now, supposing you tell me what it proves. Maybe there are 10 knives like that, so what?
Maybe there are.
Well, what does it mean? You found another knife like it. What's that, the discovery of the age or something?
You mean you're asking us to believe that somebody else did the stabbing with exactly the same kind of knife?
The odds are 1,000,001.
It's possible,
but not very probable.
Okay, fellas, let's take our seats. There's no point standing around all over the place.
But that begins to sow the seeds of doubt in the other jurors that, well, wait, it is possible. And here's the thing, that the defense does not have to prove innocence. All they have to prove is that the prosecution has not made their case. As long as there is something that can give reasonable doubt, an abiding conviction, something that can take away that abiding conviction that the suspect, the defendant, is guilty, that's all the defense has to do. And so you say, well, just because the boy had a knife like this that he lost and someone else stabbed his father with the same kind of knife, there are other knives like this. Now, if he had a good defense attorney, he would have gone to the shop himself, bought the knife, and brought it into court. What juror number 8 does is against the rules. That would be grounds for a mistrial right there because you've introduced evidence that the prosecution's not able to rebut or qualify with any kind of expert witness or testimony. By the way, I am debating. I love 12 Angry Men. It's a great stage play, one of my favorite movies. I watched it with Laura a few weeks ago. I just love the characters involved in it. I've always thought it would be fun to do a one-man production of 12 Angry Men. Like, you heard the one guy there, juror number 3 is the main antagonist. He's Lee Cobb. And he says, what is that supposed to mean? Discovery of the ages or something? What does that prove? I'm just saying that it's possible. Yes, but not very probable. You means to tell me it was the same knife? The odds are 1,000,000 to 1. Well, he's just saying that maybe he did do it. I don't know. You know, so I'm thinking maybe I should do a one-man production of 12 Angry Men. You know, who knows? I'll give it a try. Maybe that'll be a special bonus episode of the Council of Trent. And if it goes well, I'll take it on the road and have some fun at a community theater. You all have been wonderful. Thanks for being with us. Be sure to check out that bonus content if you are a patron at TrenthornPodcast.com. Hope you all enjoyed this show, and I hope that you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.